Tonight on Arena, we review Crook Manifesto, the latest offering from Pulitzer Prize winner Colson Whitehead, and we preview The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, the new Prime Video series set in Australia. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Lizzo, the stage name of Melissa Vivian Jefferson, has become a global musical sensation since her third studio album, 'Cause I Love You, which topped the charts around the world in 2019. Led, of course, by sensational singles like Juice and Tempo. In the course of that ascent, she has become something of a feminist icon to many, promoting self-confidence in young women, body positivity and anti-bullying. All the more surprising then that news has broken of court cases filed against Lizzo and her dance captain Shirlene Quigley by three of her former dancers, alleging, amongst other things, bullying and sexual harassment. Aoife Barry has been looking at the case in detail and she joins me now. Aoife, I suppose the first point here is that this really will come as a source of real disappointment to a lot of people who look up to Lizzo as a champion for women across the board. Of course, these are allegations and complaints. There may be nothing to them. But people will be surprised even by mention of that, I think, won't they?
Yeah, I think Lizzo is probably the last person that people would have imagined in the entertainment industry would have these kind of allegations made about her or a lawsuit like this appear, you know, because she is someone who's really well known for being, like you're saying there, you know, body positive, very feminist musician. Her songs are really very positive. She's someone who has faced a lot of criticism for her size. You know, people can be really, really awful and nasty about Lizzo, and she persists. You know, she's someone who has just been very much herself throughout her career, and that's what's made her so popular. And I think so this has come as, you know, as a big shock to a lot of her fans. If you look online today, a lot of people are quite surprised to see these allegations coming out.
Well, what exactly is involved here in the lawsuit that has been filed, not just against Lizzo, but against her dance captain as well, Shirlene Quigley?
Sure. So there's three former dancers for Lizzo who are involved in filing the lawsuit. So they're called Ariana Davis, Crystal Williams and Noelle Rodriguez. Now, Davis and Williams first started performing with Lizzo after they took part on a show called Watch Out for the Big Girls, which is basically a dance competition show held to get backing dancers for Lizzo, and that was on Amazon in 2021. And then the third of them, Noelle Rodriguez, she was hired the same year. She performed in the video Rumours, and she was hired after that. But like I said, none of them actually work for Lizzo anymore. Davis and Williams were let go, but Rodriguez resigned after Davis and Williams were let go. And, you know, in their suit, they name Lizzo under her real name, but they also name her production company, Big Girl Big Touring Inc., and Shirlene Quigley, who's her dance captain. They are the defendants in it. And there's a number of different claims under different headings. So the claims include
Oh, we seem to have lost.
Sorry, Aoife, we lost you briefly there.
So you were just explaining what the various claims that have been made were.
Sure. So the claims include sexual harassment, creation of a hostile work environment, false imprisonment and interference with prospective economic advantage. But all of these weren't brought against every single defendant. They were brought against, you know, different ones were brought against different people. So, you know, for example, just looking at the allegations, and there's quite a few of them, so I'll just mention a few. One of the claims was that Lizzo pressured one dancer to touch a nude performer at a club, and out of fear of retaliation, the dancer acquiesced to doing it, but they said they didn't want to do so. There are also claims about a 12-hour audition that was held after accusations about the dancers drinking while working, which the dancers deny. There was also a claim about Lizzo allegedly inviting the dancers to a club in Paris without telling them that it was actually a nude cabaret bar, and some of the dancers wouldn't have wanted to attend if they'd known that. There are claims too about the production end of things, that the production team was mostly white and that black dancers were treated differently, and indeed that dancers in general were treated differently and that things were a lot more strict. And then the false imprisonment claim, that's actually related to Davis recording a meeting. She said she had to record these meetings on her phone because sometimes she wasn't able to process information if she was stressed. And when it came out that she had a video, Lizzo was allegedly angry about this, and Davis was asked to buy security security to stay behind and to show the video on her phone, which she said she claimed amounted to false imprisonment. So it's a hefty document of claims, but they come under a lot of different headings.
We've mentioned Lizzo and the claim or the esteem in which she is held. What about Shirlene Quigley? I think she is something of a legend in dance circles.
She's definitely a big name in the backup dancer world. So she was actually in Beyonce's video Crazy in Love, which came out a whopping 20 years ago in 2003. She went on to work after that with people like Rihanna, Jamie Foxx, Mary J. Blige. She started working for Lizzo in 2019, and she's basically been on the road with her since then. And she's performed at loads of different awards like the VMAs, the Grammys. And then she was also a judge on Lizzo's reality TV show, Watch Out for the Girls. And she's really popular in social media. She's a very religious person, and she talks a lot about her faith and her career as well on Instagram.
Yeah, she is a devout Christian. And have her Christian beliefs been at the centre of another allegation, in fact?
Yeah, so there are allegations that Quigley pushed her Christian beliefs upon other performers and denigrated people who'd had premarital sex, which is something that she didn't believe in due to her religion. And that, you know, they claimed that there was kind of different sexual topics were brought into conversation, like Davis's virginity, for example, they allege was talked about. You know, the lawsuit doesn't say, though, whether Lizzo knew about Quigley's alleged behaviour, but it does go into a lot of detail about what she's alleged to have done. Now, she hasn't commented on it, but she did put up an Instagram post since the news broke, and in it she didn't mention it at all, that she said that she feels very blessed, she feels very full of joy, she talks about God in it, and she says she had a great time on tour. So that's all that she has said since all of this has broken, but again, doesn't specifically mention all of these claims at all.
And has Lizzo made any comment?
No, Lizzo has said nothing so far. She has been approached by different media about it, but she hasn't commented at all. And, you know, we don't know when or if this will actually get to court, because in a lawsuit like this, it could be settled out of court. There's an assistant professor at the School of Law in University of California who talked to the New York Times. She basically said that proving a hostile work environment in the kind of unconventional entertainment industry is quite difficult. So the lawyers for the plaintiffs would probably, she said, be hoping for a settlement. So, you know, in that case, there wouldn't be, you know, a public court case. But regardless of what happens, there'll be a huge amount of media around what happens with this going forward, and a lot of attention on whether or not Lizzo releases a statement and what she says in that.
Yeah, and of course that media circus will be much beloved, and I guess the potential knockers of Lizzo will be only too quick to jump on potential bandwagons in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely there already. You know, I was looking on Twitter and there's very high profile right leaning accounts that are already, you know, fat shaming Lizzo, are trying to say that her weight has something to do with this alleged behaviour. It's really vile stuff that's out there on social media about her at the moment, because she does have a lot of critics in the kind of conservative circles who are only too happy to see some allegations like this come out and use it as an excuse, you know, to try and blame her and her weight for alleged behaviour. So it's pretty nasty out there if you search for things about Lizzo today. So I would imagine her team are probably, you know, in crisis talks at the moment, trying to figure out how to put out a statement, because obviously if she denies everything in this, she'll want to be saying she denies it, but she might have other comments to make as well too. All of the women have been out doing media on different news outlets in the US too, so it's a huge story today in the entertainment world.
Yeah, I'm sure we will be hearing more about it too as the days and weeks go on. That's Aoife Barry. Thanks for being with us on that, Aoife. That's Aoife Barry there. And let's finish with some music from Lizzo, a song called Good As Hell.
I do my hair toss, check my nails, baby, how you feeling?
Good as hell.
Hair toss, check my nails, baby, how you feeling?
Good as hell.
Ooh, child, tired of the bullshit, gone dust your shoulders off, keep it moving, yes, Lord, trying to get some new shit in there, swimwear, going to the pool shit. Come now, come dry your eyes.
And that is Lizzo with Good As Hell. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena.
The French are bred to die for love. They delight in fighting duels. But I prefer a man who lives and gives.
Are a girl's best friend.
Marilyn Monroe singing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend from the musical comedy Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, directed by Howard Hawks. It was released in the summer of 1953, 70 years ago. It stars, of course, Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell. They play Lorelei and Dorothy, two showgirls who are best friends. The pair travel to France on a cruise ship in search of love, money and diamonds. Paul Whittington has been watching the film once again and he joins me in studio this evening. It's the dynamic between the two women that, for me, is the most immediate and interesting thing about this film, Paul. Yeah. Maybe explain who they are and the kind of the setup that the film has.
Well, to be honest, until I watched it again for the purposes of this, I had it in my mind as some kind of very much of its time and, you know, with all the sort of sexist certainties of its day. But it's not like that at all. Mm. It's actually, in a kind of very modest way, subversive. The two of them, the two girls, Lorelei and Dorothy are showgirls and they perform musical numbers. They do one at the start. The songs are very good in this, actually. They go backstage and Lorelei makes it very clear that she wants to marry somebody wealthy. She's obsessed with diamonds and she owns it. She loves them. She wants to marry a rich person. And indeed, she has arranged to do so. Whereas Dorothy is actually more interested. She's equally shallow, you could say, but she's very upfront about it. She likes the muscular, athletic type of man and at one point will actually surround herself with the entire Olympic team as she does this song. So the serious part of it is that they realise the social imperative of having to do it because they're showgirls. So if they don't, you know, get out of it in some respectable fashion, they'll be in trouble.
Their lives will not be pleasant to live.
Yeah.
And Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe, where were they at in their careers when the film was cast?
Well, Jane Russell had been, as you know, had been one of the sort of pin-ups towards the end of the Second World War, and she was a very glamorous looking person. And I mean, I think like Monroe, she had her limitations as an actress, but she was a good comedian and didn't always get the chance to do it. And in this film, she was very much an established star at this point. In this film, she did get the chance. For Marilyn had been objectified in a series of films. She was just becoming at her most famous. She had married Joe DiMaggio, which would be a very unhappy marriage, of course. And she was about to run into this great stream of films that everybody remembers. But this was the first film where she got the chance to show that she could take control of her image and sort of use it for comedic effect. And I think she's very good in it, actually.
And I don't know if it's a MacGuffin or not. They're put on a ship on its way to Paris to kind of, I suppose, to have everybody in the one place all the time as much as anything else.
Yeah, it is. And that was a classic Hollywood trope. The Marx Brothers did it. Everybody did it. But the function in the plot is that she was supposed to be going to Paris with her.
At one point,
she asks for directions to Europe, France, but she kind of owns that as well.
Yeah.
But and the wealthy boyfriend is forbidden to go by his millionaire father, who sends a spy to sort of catch her out instead. So that's the reason why they're
on the boat. She's on the boat and the boat is full of very wealthy people and she goes through the passenger list looking for the possibilities of a very rich man who might
She finds Piggy, but it's all rather innocent really, because she kind of, for instance, she has a chance to blackmail this Piggy and she doesn't do it. Like she's actually oddly moral. She just is obsessed with diamonds and wishes to own an awful lot of them.
Yeah, well, let's listen to it. The Piggy in question is a very wealthy mine owner and he's played by Charles Coburn.
A great character actor.
Yeah, and he's also married. His wife is on the ship with him, which is slightly problematic for some of the Lorelei exploits.
Yes.
Norma Varden is the wife. And here they are, Marilyn Monroe with Piggy at the table and the wife joins as well. Lorelei cannot help but notice the diamonds that Lady Beekman is wearing, and then Lady Beekman proceeds to describe those items of jewellery.
I am quite proud of the earrings. Heirlooms, you know. Been in the family for ages.
You never know it. They look just like new.
Oh, quite. You might be interested in my tiara. I always carry it with me, afraid to leave it in the stateroom.
And you're not afraid to show it to Lorelei?
Yeah, stop. Lady Beekman won't know you're teasing. Did you ever, anywhere, anything like it?
All blue stones. Cozy little job, what?
May I just hold it for a minute?
Of course.
How do you put it around your neck?
You don't, lovey. It goes on your head.
You must think I was born yesterday.
Well, sometimes there's just no other possible explanation.
No, no, my dear, she's quite right. Like so. It's a tiara.
You do wear it on your head. I just love finding new places to wear diamonds.
Marilyn Monroe there as Lorelei, and also in the clip we heard Lady Beekman, played by Norma Varden, her husband, played by Charles Coburn, affectionately known as Piggy Beekman. You also heard Jane Russell as Dorothy, the friend of Lorelei, in the midst of all of that. You see, Paul, I listen to that and I hear very much, I explain to me how she's not just playing the part of, and I hate this term, but it's the term that's used, the dumb blonde, because she is has to play some rather stupid lines there.
She has some rather stupid lines, but I think they're all part of this kind of routine that she has, because men are terrified of her because of what she looks like, attracted and terrified of her. And at one point, I believe it was an ad-libbed line.
We'll come to that line later on. Yeah.
I think that there is a lot of happening underneath, and she lets that show. And it's all about modes of survival in this patriarchal world, really. And you notice in this film time and again that, like, the chorus girls in this film are men.
Yeah,
which was just did not happen, and a lot of it is the female gaze rather than the male gaze, yeah, which is what is interesting about it.
There's a whole big sequence. Yeah. It's the Olympic team, as we said, is on this ship, which is quite handy for the Jane Russell character, who loves a well built man.
Yes,
and we see them doing a kind of a Busby Berkeley kind of
around her.
Dance routine around her.
She looks very comfortable in the middle of it.
And she's looking at their bodies, at their physique, at their muscles. Yeah. So that is turned on its head.
Absolutely.
And you reckon that in the case of Marilyn Monroe's performance here, there is enough of the knowingness in what she's doing that it removes it from that awful label of dumb blonde.
Absolutely. And the thing is, she's in control of the comedy all the time. And that's what was interesting about it, because she hadn't really been asked to do that before, unless she would prove again in three or four films, like 7 Year Itch and obviously
Some
Like It Hot. She was very good at it, and people kind of mistake that persona she did for her, and it wasn't her.
And now I'll go to the clip that you're talking about. She is engaged to be married to this young fellow, Gus Esmond, played by Tommy Noonan. His father totally disapproves of the marriage, and that is why this spy, this police PI, private detective, is on the ship watching what they're doing. But towards the end of the film, father, or potential father-in-law, and potential daughter-in-law come face to face, and he still has to be convinced. So let's have a listen to the scene between them. You'll hear Marilyn Monroe. The son, Gus, is played by Tommy Noonan, and the father, Esmond Senior, played here by Taylor Holmes.
Young lady, you don't fool me one bit.
I'm not trying to, but I bet I could, though.
No, you might convince this jackass that you love him, but you'll never convince me.
That's too bad, because I do love him.
Certainly, for his money.
No. Honestly.
Have you got the nerve to stand there and expect me to believe that you don't want to marry my son for his money?
It's true.
Then what do you want to marry him for?
I want to marry him for your money.
There. Lorelei.
Don't you see that's why we have to have his consent, silly?
Well, at least we're getting down to brass tacks. You admit that all you're after is money.
No, I don't. Aren't you funny? Don't you know that a man being rich is like a girl being pretty? You might not marry a girl just because she's pretty, but my goodness, doesn't it help? And if you had a daughter, wouldn't you rather she didn't marry a poor man?
But I was...
You'd want her to have the most wonderful things in the world and to be very happy. Oh, why is it wrong for me to want those things?
Well, I concede that... Say, they told me you were stupid. You don't sound stupid to me.
I can be smart when it's important, but most men don't like it.
There you go. That's the line.
And apparently she did. She did.
She ad-libbed that line. Yeah, most men don't like it.
Because she had found it in her life, this disconnect between what she looked like and what people expected of her.
Yeah, that's a scene from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Marilyn Monroe, obviously in the starring role as Lorelei. And within that clip, we also heard Tommy Noonan as Gus, the fiancé of the Lorelei character, and Taylor Holmes as his father. Clearly about to be won over,
yes,
we would guess. I did want to talk a little bit as well, though, about Jane Russell and the character that she plays within this, the Dorothy character. Yes, there is this constant thing of the male gaze, but she knows what she wants, and she seems to be a more straightforward character. Is that a fair way to put it, or a more understandable character, perhaps?
I think she is. I think she is a more straightforward character, and she has a certain amount of cynicism about things. She's actually more realistic than Laurie is, who's kind of a romantic, despite the fact she's obsessed with diamonds. Jane Russell's character, Dorothy, is very down to earth. She sees what's going on all the time. She laughs at her friend, but very affectionately, and they're extremely loyal to each other. There's a real sisterhood there. They never, ever contemplate
they both abandoning really, each other. Yeah. They both back each other up in several situations within the
which
film.
Which is another unfortunate trope in Hollywood that you would have. They debunk that as well, you know.
The idea that the two women,
you know, they would be fighting.
There's total loyalty here. In fact, we hear it in the very first scene where, it's not quite the first scene where Malone, played by Elliot Reid, who, spoiler alert, but he is the private detective doing the investigating. The problem is he's also fallen in love with Dorothy along the way. And so he's in trouble. He has loyalty issues to sort out here. But here's the moment where the two of them sit down together at a table. Malone, played by Elliot Reid, and Dorothy, played by Jane Russell.
Let's go find our moon and forget about your girlfriend.
Anyway, I'd probably get in trouble if I pushed Piggy overboard.
Not with me. Anyway, why blame Piggy? It's not all his fault.
No, just what did you mean by that remark?
Well, let's say I just can't figure out how two girls can be so different and be such good friends.
Now listen, Malone, let's get this straight. Nobody talks about Lorelei but me. She's quite a girl, you just don't know her.
You don't mind if I like you better, do you?
There you see. Elliot Reid is Malone and Dorothy, played by Jane Russell, in the scene from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, the film, which is 70 years old this year. And you can get, it's there what you were talking about, Paul Whittington, looking at the film first. The loyalty is crystal clear in that scene.
Absolutely. They've kind of come up together, that they understand each other, that they understand their situation and how it has to be improved. They just disagree over how they're going to improve it. We heard earlier Marilyn singing. She had a weak singing voice, and that's no secret. But the songs in this film are great, and they sort of suit her. And obviously there's one in particular that really suits her voice, you know.
Well, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. You can't ignore that. Yeah. But there are others too. She does a kind of a slow version of Bye Bye Baby when she slows it right down. She's able to play that very well.
And the two girls from Little Rock is at the start is great.
Howard Hawks is the director here. Again, he had some great comedies already on
His Girl Friday, Bringing Up Baby, all those screwballs, but this was not a screwball. And he'd William Lederer who wrote His Girl Friday, which was actually very ahead of its time. That's the Cary Grant Rosalind Russell film where he's this newspaper editor and she's a reporter, and she is the protagonist as well, so he had some history in this department. But Hawks had no interest in the choreography, and there's an official choreographer, but it was Gwen Verdon who did of Verdon Fossey, you know, who became a very famous person. She was young at that point. She did some of the choreography, which accounts for the female gaze of it. You
know. And the choreography, some huge big numbers.
Yes.
Some of them kind of like Ravel's La Valse, kilter waltz, very cleverly done and shot in Technicolor. Yeah. It looks amazing. The famous pink dress.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. There was a kind of a bar in Hollywood. They were really good at this stuff at that point. You couldn't do things like that if you didn't do them properly. There was no room for amateur musicals like La La Land. You had to do them well. And that routine, it's been so copied by everybody from Madonna to Beyonce, but it's a wonderful routine.
One thing I did want to just say about the two women and the dynamic between them, the dynamic in terms of pay difference was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and that was not Jane Russell's fault. That came out afterwards.
Who earned more? Who earned
Jane Russell. She got 20 grand for the film, which is a lot, whereas Pearl and Marilyn got 500 a week. And she was told she wasn't the star, and she said, "Well, I might not be the star, but I am the blonde," which I thought was great. But that would change subsequent to this film.
Finally, Paul, I mean, when we look at this film with 2023 eyes, are the problems within it, as well as the things that you're saying, do stand up and prove that there's some kind of critique in there? Subversive, I think, might be going a bit too far, is it?
Well, I mean, it's obviously, you know, female empowerment in the kind of dolled up 1950s way, and obviously, you know, a feminists could be appalled by the fact that they're seeking advancement, you know, through marriage to rich people or whatever. But perhaps that was all that was available to them. I was surprised by how much, if you like, subversiveness there was in there, and by how much it was not a film viewed through male eyes, which I had remembered it as. It was one of my mother's favourite films, and watching it again, I really realised why.
That's Paul Whittington speaking to us about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which is 70 years old this year. Now, based on the 2018 best-selling debut novel by Australian writer Holly Ringland, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart is a new 7-part series on Prime Video set in rural Australia. This is a family drama spanning decades, follows Alice of the title as she grows from her complicated past. But we start with 9-year-old Alice as she lives on the outskirts of town with her father and pregnant mother when a mysterious fire devastates their house. Enter Sigourney Weaver as June Hart, the grandmother that Alice has never met. Dave Hanratty has been watching The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, and he's with me in studio this evening. The opening scene, I've only seen the first episode, which I must say hooked me right in really, really quickly. We start with this little girl, this little 9-year-old girl, in, to say the very least, a difficult situation, Dave.
Yeah, and we should say at the outset that this is a difficult show in some respects. I mean, every episode actually starts with a disclaimer for the audience about, you know, that there are themes of domestic violence and other kind of harrowing aspects of life that will be, I guess, reckoned with in this show. And so from the very, very start, you know that you're dealing with a very serious adult drama. And this is a slow burn as well. I mean, it's a 7-episode miniseries, but each episode's, you know, roughly kind of 50 minutes to an hour long. And it takes its time. It's extremely glacial in terms of its pace.
I suppose that speaks back to its novel origins, I suppose, its origins in it as a book.
Yeah, which is multi-layered. I mean, you mentioned it yourself there at the start. This is a decades-spanning story. Mm. So, you know, we have the Alice Hart character we're first introduced as a 9-year-old girl who is, you know, fresh off a traumatic incident, a life-changing incident that will see her ripped from her family home and placed with the Sigourney Weaver character of her grandmother on a farm, which is itself a refuge for women who have fled violence. And we will also meet the adult version of Alice in time as well as the series progresses. So there's a lot to cover, a lot of ground to cover here, and they do it with a lot of patience, and I think patience is required from the viewer as well.
Yeah, and one of the scenes, one of the ideas that runs through that early episode is domestic violence is there in the household from the outset, and it's good that the programme gives its disclaimer on that before each episode. And in fact, I should warn that even within this clip that we're about to play, the references to domestic violence are upsetting, because we're talking about a 9-year-old girl here, and we know that the situation, even after a couple of minutes, we know that the situation she's with her parents is very difficult. And at this point, the policeman, John Morgan is the character here, played by Alexander England. He comes to visit the house because Alice has gone wandering in her nightgown, and the local librarian has noticed some disturbing bruises on her arms. So young Alice is played here by Alia. I don't know how to say her first name. Actually, I've tried it several times now. Alelia, I think it is, Brown. Her dad, Clem, is played by Charlie Vickers. And her mom, Agnes, is played by Tilda Cobham-Hervey.
Yeah, mate.
Hey. Apologise for turning up unannounced. Can I come in?
Come on through.
Can I get you a cup of tea or...?
No. Don't go to any trouble.
Sorry about the mess.
No. Just following up after Alice's visit to the library.
Ah, yeah. She's an adventurous little thing. Scared the pants off everyone, but no harm done.
Look, I won't waste your time. The librarian reported seeing bruising on Alice's arms and legs.
Alice is always climbing trees.
Just roughhousing with the dog, mate. Gets herself covered in bruises.
Is this your dog, Alice?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Toby.
Toby to blame for all these bruises?
He didn't mean to hurt me.
There we go. It could be as simple as Alila, actually, as I look at it. Alila Brown playing the part of young Alice there. Charlie Vickers playing the part of the father, Clem, and the mum played by Tilda Cobham-Hervey as they're interviewed by the local policeman, Alexander England, as John Morgan. This is in The Last Flowers of Alice Hart. And just Dave Hanratty be watching it for us. Just as we go into that scene, the mother sees the policeman arriving up, the car coming up the driveway towards the house. immediately puts a top on the young girl and says, just let your father tell the story. And it really, even the underplaying that is in that scene, it speaks to how this subject is handled so deftly in the series for me, certainly on the basis of the first episode, Dave.
Yeah, no, it's little details like that that show you the complexities of the situation and the harrowing nature thereof. And I think as well, with regards to how the show treats this kind of thing and treats domestic violence as a subject matter, as a real life thing, I never once really felt that it was, you know, exploitative. Like, it felt very sensitive. I think that they did a very strong job here of not going beyond the line with it, really. I mean, there are some characters that are more one note than others in one sense, but at the same time, just how this is put across, it didn't feel soap opera to me. It felt real. And yeah. I think that that's very clearly what they're trying to get across with these characters. And even the characters that you heard in that clip there, who are kind of like more supporting players, very good actors, and they make it feel very genuine and very, very real, which adds, of course, not just to the drama, but to the horror of this, because this is like clearly like this show is about more than just fictional characters. It is trying to reflect the difficulties that women face in life and how often they're not listened to. And as you said there as well, not that they're complicit in their own actions, but they've no choice but to, you know, be under the kind of the thrall of an abuser. So like, it's all of those complexities are in play here, and I think that the showrunner did Sarah Lambert, I think is her name, did a really, really very good and admirable job with that.
Yeah, and I presume that is reflected in the novel that Holly Ringland, which was a huge hit in Australia, maybe not as big a hit up this part of the world, but it was a huge hit down under. Then Sigourney Weaver enters the scene. We don't need to get into the whys and wherefores that she's there, but the little girl is going to be taken out of the family situation for various reasons that people can see when they watch that first episode. Sigourney Weaver, I suppose she is, we won't recognise necessarily the Australian actors here, but we'll certainly recognise Sigourney Weaver as an international audience. I guess that's the draw here for Prime Video. She's a big get, Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah, and she was certainly the draw for me. I mean, beyond just being asked to review the show, I was very curious to see what she would do here, because I think she's one of the great actors, one of the great actresses. Of course, we all know her from the Alien franchise, but she's done so much more. At the same time, she's had a hell of a career, but I wonder if it could have been even more gilded or something. You know, she's been around for the last two decades, but maybe not as much as we would like. And so for her to take on this character, and it's a very complex character with a lot of hidden secrets. The show is all about hidden secrets.
Everybody has secrets here.
Completely, yeah. And Sigourney Weaver in every single scene is just, it's an incredible performance. It's very understated, but she is magnificent in every frame.
And she arrives at the family home. There's been a fire. There are difficulties with the fire. The young girl is in hospital, and she goes, Sigourney Weaver, as June, as the grandmother, goes to see her granddaughter, who she has never met up to this point. And this is the exchange in the hospital as she arrives.
Ella still isn't conscious, but you can talk to her. She can probably hear you.
Butterfly bush means second chances.
Well, she has multiple fractures. Her right lung is collapsed, and there's damage to her trachea from a trauma.
What kind of trauma?
It looks like she's been choked.
And the baby?
We had him airlifted to a neonatal unit in Sydney, but realistically, a baby born at 25 weeks, 700 grams without his mother, the outlook isn't good.
So that is the news that Sigourney Weaver's June is faced with as she, June Hart, yeah, because she's the grandmother. That's the news that she's faced with as she arrives at the hospital. This is all part of the Prime Video series, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, that Dave Hanratty has been watching for us. It gives you a sense, again, just the sheer violence of the various acts that happen across this series. As I say, I've only seen episode one, but I think that continues right through the kind of the disturbing stories that were told, Dave.
Yeah, and that violence doesn't necessarily have to be physical. I mean, there's so much emotional violence running through this show as well. And again, we have to stress that this is a show to be approached with a certain level of caution due to the nature of the subject matter. But like I say, I think it is handled quite deftly. And every scene is just powered by this undercurrent of trauma and scarring, and there's, you know, like there's all these broken relationships and broken people who are just kind of trying their best. Very much encapsulated by the Sigourney Weaver character in lots of respects. I know it is Alice Hart is in the title, but it's kind of the Sigourney Weaver show when she's on screen. And this character, who is this kind of stern matriarchal figure and has a reputation amongst the local populace, quite a negative one, but at the same time, she's clearly a savior of women. She has this refuge that they come to, and she's a mother figure to all of them.
Yeah, and the wonderful thing that starts to develop between grandmother and granddaughter is this, the use of flowers as a way of speaking, which is where The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, which is where the title of the book and the series comes from. Maybe explain a little bit of that to us.
So, I mean, the flower thing has a double meaning, because the women I've mentioned who come to the farm, the Thornfield farm that they're on, you know, they get referred to as flowers as well. But in terms of, you know, they grow and cultivate these kind of rare flowers on this farm, and Sigourney Weaver's character teaches the young Alice, who is not speaking after the traumatic event she's been through, that flowers can actually be their own communication tools, and they can say the things that we find too heavy and too painful to state out loud. So they actually act as their own kind of form of language. And so, and all this, I should say, is captured with very, very rich cinematography. This is a beautiful looking show. Money was spent, yeah, and you can see that in the kind of the low lighting and the hushed hues. They're trying, like I've talked before on here about shows that don't look like cinema in an era when, you know, every show is meant to be a cinematic event. This looks like it was made for the big screen. It really, really does.
And in terms of when we get to that refuge, how much does the story expand out from simply grandmother and granddaughter into perhaps the stories of some of the women who are in the refuge that Sigourney Weaver runs on this farm?
Yeah, the vast majority of them have a role to play and are inhabited by, first of all, great actors. And, you know, despite the fact that it's 7 episodes and these episodes are slow burning, some characters are just kind of put to the wayside, because that's just the way you can only get so many people like into the script. But it all matters, and everyone has a kind of a connective tissue to what is going on. And the more the show goes on, the more you will find out in that regard. Alice, of course, in particular, as she gets older, and that's not a spoiler, it's a decade-spanning show, midway through the series and a new actress plays her, and she kind of leaves the situation she's in, goes out into the world, you will see the knock-on effect that the upbringing she had has on her when she's out in the quote-unquote real world.
There is another aspect of the story, we don't need to go too far down it, but in that early scene when the young Alice, the little 9-year-old girl, wanders into town in her nightgown, she goes into the library and she becomes friendly practically immediately with Asher Keddie, who plays the character of Sally, who's the local librarian. And is she married? Or certainly her partner is the local policeman who we heard going to the farm earlier on. She's a vital cog in the story and what propels the story here.
Yeah, we find it early on that she discovers that she has been put down as, if the Sigourney Weaver character proves to be unfit as a guardian, then the Sally character is essentially asked to take in Alice. And so she develops an interest in her. She already had an interest in terms of protecting her. But, you know, kind of a bit of a battle will ensue between those two characters over the welfare of this titular character, Alice Hart.
Now, you did say this is a slow burn, which can be a good thing or can be a bad thing. Did it have enough momentum? Because it is across 7 episodes, and more than once on this programme I've heard reviewers say it didn't need to be 7 episodes. Do you think it merits its 7 episodes? Did each of them hold you?
I think it just does it, because I've seen without getting into spoilers, I've seen the whole series now. I've seen all 7 episodes, and I think it ends very, very strongly. There was a couple of moments in the midsection I felt were a bit baggy, and I felt a little bit kind of going in circles, but you also need to spend time with the different versions of the characters at different time periods, so I understand that. Sure, if you wanted to be ruthless, you could have cut off maybe 1 or 2 episodes, but it doesn't outstay its welcome. I think when it does actually get to the conclusion, you're like, okay, fair enough, I'm glad I invested my time in this, and it hits the landing very, very strongly once it finally gets there. It's guilty of a few kind of indulgent tropes, but at the same time, I'm glad that we have an adult drama, you know, like kind of, which feels like an original story. The story could be a little bit more compelling for me, but the acting is so strong that I was glued when I knew him was kind of on screen getting to do that, especially, and I can't stress it enough, Sigourney Weaver is just wonderful here.
Yeah, and I suppose that slow burn quality, if you're patient with it, there is a payoff.
Yeah, there is a payoff. I think if you're looking for a traditional kind of mystery, like there is an overhanging mystery to this from the beginning, but it's kind of background. I mean, I think if you're looking for a conventional, you know, like massive cliffhangers, not really.
This isn't the one.
Not really. The revelations here are more internally explosive than kind of, you know, soap opera shocking. So, you know, have patience with it, and it should reward you, but just don't be going in expecting traditional, conventional roller coaster thrills.
That internal explosion sounds good to me. That's Dave Hanratty speaking to us about The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, which launches on Prime Video this Friday. American author Colson Whitehead came to international attention in 2016 with The Underground Railroad, the first of two Pulitzer Prize-winning novels from him, the second being The Nickel Boys, which we got in 2019. Crook Manifesto is his latest book, the second in a series in New York's Harlem about 50 years ago, featuring the character of Ray Carney, part respectable businessman and part criminal, just like his father. The previous novel in this series, Harlem Shuffle, unfolded in the 1960s in New York, where Ray got sucked into dodgy schemes, and you just know that it wasn't going to end well for him. Crook Manifesto takes up with Ray again in Harlem, but this time we're into the 1970s. Richard Aldous has been reading the novel for us, and he joins me on the line now. This is 1970s New York, and that's quite a setting to have. But let's just work out where Ray Carney is at the beginning of this novel and how much you need to know about the previous novel to understand him. Does Colson Whitehead give us enough to just go straight into book two in the trilogy, Richard?
Hello, Sean. Yeah, he absolutely does. That if you've read the previous novel, then you're fleshing out this character of Ray Carney. But you can come into this really knowing nothing because, as you described, Ray Carney in the previous novel was a fence of stolen goods. But by the beginning of this new novel, he's a reformed character. He's decided to go straight. So he's working in his furniture store. But then his teenage daughter wants tickets to a Jackson 5 concert. He can't afford it, and so he gets drawn back into that world of criminality again. So yeah, it's a very easy concept, I think, for any father to understand.
Yeah, I hope that nobody listening tonight will follow Ray Carney's example in terms of trying to get tickets for Taylor Swift potentially. Indeed. For their teenage daughter. But this is back at the time Ray Carney trying to get tickets for the Jackson 5 and finds himself kind of pulled back into the world that he has tried to get out to. And it's interesting that the book is in three sections, kind of the early 70s, the mid 70s, 72, 73, I think, then for the second section, and then a little bit later into the 70s for the third section. But that opening section starts with the lines, or as the setup, as it were: crooked stays crooked and bent hits straight. So we know Ray really, you know, he's not going to be able to stay straight, really, is he, or at all?
No, and there are some nice lines, for example, where he talks about being able to go for several hours without thinking about kind of breaking this promise that he's made, and so on. But it is interesting, though, because throughout the novel, this character Ray Carney, you do kind of believe in him as a good figure. There's something essentially good about him as a character, but he's constantly tempted. And throughout the rest of the book, you kind of see characters who are kind of genuinely malicious, malignant. So on the kind of the scale of things, he's almost in that kind of line of kind of someone like Philip Roth, of a, you know, an essentially good man who's drawn over to the bad side, if you like, but is surrounded by kind of characters who are much, much worse. So there's a moral ambivalence about him, but not really an evil about him.
We're in 1970s New York. How important is that period in New York's history? I mean, and what kind of picture does Colson Whitehead paint for us of 1970s New York?
Yeah, this is actually one of the very best things about the novel. It seems to me that kind of Colson Whitehead, I mean, he writes so beautifully. That's the first thing that we should say. But he manages to evoke this sense of New York in the 1970s, and not in a kind of a very straightforward, two-dimensional way that, you know, perhaps we might think of. When we think of 70s New York, we think of it as a kind of a place of crime, that it's kind of been dragged down, and all of those kind of aspects are there, but this is a very multifaceted depiction of the cities. And again, he has some kind of nice lines that, for example, he says, you know that things are bad when even the Upper East Side looks terrible. So, you know, there's this kind of sense of New York as a living, breathing place, Harlem in particular. But he steps back from the kind of simplistic view of New York, including it. it has to be said, along the kind of the whole racial understanding of New York during that period, where, again, he's very, very nuanced in the way that he writes about these things.
And how does he manage that nuance to give us that kind of, because it's a very difficult period to write about. And when we move into the second section of the novel, we get into a situation where essentially we're talking about within Ray Carney's furniture showrooms that it's been used kind of as the set for a black exploitation film.
That's right. So that's the second part of the novel, and then the third part of the novel, also set in this same kind of part of Harlem, deals with the kind of the firebombing and famous arson attacks of that period. So you see a very complex picture of Harlem, and it was only really once I'd finished the novel, maybe even a kind of a day or so after I'd finished it, that I realised that actually in some ways this novel is about moderation versus extremism, that Ray Carney is essentially a moderate man, and he's surrounded by extremism, including in Harlem, including things like the Black Panthers, the Black Liberation Army, and so on, who are kind of exploiting racial tensions for their own purposes. But then you also see the other side of that with the kind of the corrupt police officer character. So you see this, as I say, this very complex, multifaceted, unsimplistic way of presenting New York in that period.
Certainly that section, you might flesh it out a little bit more about this idea of 1970s Harlem, and particular the way it was a magnet essentially for cops who were on the take, and in the case of the NYPD at the time, mostly white policemen.
That's right. I mean, it's a predominantly white police force. There's a lot of institutional corruption within the police force. And you see the kind of the interaction between the various parts of the city, whether it's the kind of the police, government officials, insurance companies, everybody on the make and on the take. And as I say, the clever thing that Colson Whitehead does is to avoid making this into a very stereotypical cliched view of all the white characters being bad and the black characters being somehow oppressed. The black characters in the novel have considerable agency. It just so happens that Ray Carney is not really one of them.
Yeah, and the other aspect of it is you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, Richard, about the style of writing. I mean, I was reading some of the opening sections, and quite simply, the way Colson Whitehead can write a sentence is frighteningly beautiful. I mean, he can say the simplest of things and it's not that it's florid language, it's just got a beautiful flow to it. But let me read the quotation that opens the third section of the novel. This is where we're in 1976. When he walked the streets, he superimposed his own perfect city over the misbegotten one before him. It was a city of ash and cinder, heaped hundreds of feet high, emptied of people, wonderfully dead and still. Kind of a hard-boiled aspect to that quotation. And that is in the novel as well, this mixture of hard-boiled style and crime thriller style and the wonderful literary flow of some of the beautiful sentences within the novel.
Yeah, and I think the word that you used kind of before was beautiful flow, and that's exactly right, that it's an incredibly flowing, easy style that he has. So that, I mean, this is genre fiction. It is supposed to be a crime novel. Sometimes this is not Lee Child or someone like that, a writer who, I should say, in that genre is absolutely superb. But this is kind of something that mixes the two in some ways and usually manages to pull it off. I think if there's a weakness, it's that Ray Carney goes missing a bit in the middle of the novel in a way that you wouldn't with, a great crime writer like Patricia Highsmith or somebody like that. But there is the effortless quality of the writing. And I think that in some ways it reminded me of one of my favourite novels, Tom Wolfe's The Bonfire of the Vanities, in the way that it's just so clever with the language, sometimes kind of taking the high road, sometimes taking the low road, this kind of mixture of different styles, but in all of it, kind of evoking this kind of teeming city that is New York City in the 1970s here.
Do we learn the Crook Manifesto if we read the entire novel?
So really, the Crook Manifesto comes in the middle of the book. I'm not going to say what it is, but the Crook Manifesto involves one of the characters who's a friend and works with Ray Carney, and he. This is all about. No, I'm not going to say any more because I don't want to.
We are told what it is.
I'm
getting a sense of perhaps is there a little bit too much tension between the literary style that we would associate with a Pulitzer Prize winner and the hard-boiled style that we might associate with a crime writer. Is that tension enough to hold you across the book, or was that the kind of that sounds as if you've some kind of doubt in that respect, Richard?
I think that if you come into this expecting it to be a traditional crime novel, then it's not going to work for you on that level. That, you know, to some degree, it's like I was thinking of those recordings that you used to get of someone like Dame Kiri Takanawa singing Beatles songs or hits from Les Miserables. That, you know, it's a beautiful voice, but it doesn't quite kind of fit.
Yeah.
But for most of, particularly the first and the third section of the book. He really does kind of manage to pull off. And where Ray Carney is involved, then
that's
fantastically done.
That's Richard Aldous. Thanks for that, Richard. Richard Aldous there. Crook Manifesto by Colson Whitehead is published by Fleet. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. I'm Dean Passadivine and Paula Shields Research. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Ashling Grufferty was on sound this evening. And the programme was produced by Olam McGowan. Back with you tomorrow night at 6:30. John Creedon is on the way.